she stared back into them, she realized that she was awake and sitting alone.
"Oh,"
she whispered, disintegrating again. When she awoke, she was in her blankets, shaking monotonously in the dim light of the bulbs. Zachary was at her side.
"Thank you for coming back. I'm so very sorry for what I said."
Zachary produced something from his pocket.
"I didn't have the money. The manager says you can owe him."
Just looking at the serrette of morphia flooded her with relief. She'd forgotten how to be alive, that was all, and now she remembered the trick of it. She stretched out her hand.
"Thank you."
Zachary held out the serrette, balled in his fist. She watched his hand with rapt attention, the smooth brown skin and pink quicks.
"Please? Remember how you always said no when I asked for a cigarette? Don't be like that. It wouldn't have been appropriate. This isn't appropriate for you."
She made herself smile.
"No, darling. It's only medicine. Like aspirin." "Aspirin didn't call me nigger."
She looked from his hand to his face.
"Please. You can have it if you want. But if you do, then don't come back here. It's not like we can't live without you."
"It's not as if."
"It's not as if we can live without you telling us it's as if."
He held his hand out, his grip seeming to loosen. She gasped. She needed the serrette more than she had ever needed anything.
"Do you want it?"
said Zachary.
"No, thank you,"
said Mary, and tried to smile, and burst into tears. All through that day and night, Zachary watched as she lay between wakefulness and sleep. Once she sat up and told Poppy Brown not to eat the blackboard chalk. She shouted at Kenneth Cox for never sitting still. Around noon she spoke in French, then fell asleep. Later there was a long, muttered conversation. She whispered that she was sorry over and over. Zachary left her bedside and went over to see what was the matter with the other children. Ruth was tearful, and Charles and Molly weren't helping. Zachary got her to come and sit with Mary. He warmed water on a primus stove and had Ruth wash Mary's face and hands while she lay, half-conscious. Ruth still wept.
"What's wrong?" said Zachary. "Is it because the others pick on you?"
She shook her head, her plaits flailing.
"Are you hungry?"
She shook her head again. He took her hand, but she pushed him away. A roar of laughter came from the theatre overhead. It must be the matinee already. He squeezed his temples to push away the exhaustion. He lit a cigarette and wished he knew what to say. He wished an older child would come to the Lyceum so he wouldn't have to be in charge. He wished someone would come who didn't need looking after.
"You like sweets?"
he said.
"I could get you some."
Ruth shrugged and said nothing.
"What about that doll you had? You want me to fetch your dolly?"
Ruth only crumpled again. Zachary supposed he ought to know what to say, but he could find no comfort in himself to transmit to her. It was just as the players said. It was a war, and they were Negroes, and even their side wasn't on their side. All they had was themselves. 19 minstrels, 9 musicians, and 4 stray children, besieged in a city besieged. If he'd still had his father, he might have felt strong about it, proud even. The players were kind to him, but however close they drew, he felt that he didn't belong. His father had wanted more for him than minstrelsy, and now that his father was gone, he felt no ties to it. Life held him in this place, that was all, like a screen trapped in a jar. There wasn't even a grave he could visit, a fixed place to start his own life from. While his father was lost, he was lost with him. All he could do was hug Ruth and tell her everything would be all right. It was the same thing the government posters were claiming. When he went back to Mary, she was awake.
"Zachary, can you get me something?"
His chest went tight. He knew she was going to want morphia.
"Sorry,"
she whispered.
"I'm so hungry."
He brought her coffee, bread and margarine. He played piano for her. In the evening, the fever came again, and she talked for hours to a man named Alistair. She argued with her mother, sometimes angrily, sometimes tearful and pleading. When her fever finally broke, she slept. He brought the other children over, and they took turns to watch her through the night. When morning came, and Mary still slept peacefully, Zachary smoothed her hair on the pillow. He stood and stretched away the night's cramps. Then he ate all the biscuits he could find, played some piano, injected the serrette of morphia into his shoulder out of pure curiosity, and went up from the basement into the Strand. He laughed out loud while the great rebuildable city glowed in the sunrise, and the old London stones in the rubble piles breathed in and out with a slow rhythm that seemed without question to swing. December 1941. At dawn, rain beat on the garret roof and leaked here and there in drips. Mary reached out a hand and tasted it. Now that the morphia was long gone from her system, the clarity of sensation was extraordinary. Things no longer shifted and warped. Until now, she had never understood how much one could love this dignified stillness of still things. There had been no major raids since May. It might all start again, of course. Mary found that she knew less of the war the longer it went on. Certainly it was still growing, drawing countries in, and when it reached sufficient size, perhaps it would come back for London. The newspapers had stopped printing situation maps, which suggested that the picture was dispiriting. She kept her anxieties to those she could do something about. Zachary had still to learn his times tables beyond six. Charles must be encouraged not to use the geometry compass as a weapon. The war expanded, and the world shrank. Memory retreated to its old boundaries and renounced its incursions into sight. Emotions submitted to the authority she had learned in childhood to exercise over them. Pleasant sensations she allowed their effervescence. Dark thoughts she quarantined. Rain drove against the skylights and streamed down the panes in sheets. It was a steady and confident rain from a vast and somber sky that seemed installed for the duration. A knock came in the early morning. The landlady, with the post. Mary thanked her and went back to bed to slit the envelopes open. The first was a begging letter from her old finishing school, inviting her to help a fresh batch of girls to, well, to finish, she supposed. The second was an aerogram from Major Simonson. "Dear Miss North, I'm sorry to write again. I assume the Army has told you that Alistair is safe, but I imagine it has exercised discretion in communicating the details." Mary put the letter down on the blanket and stared at it. It was too early in the morning to cry, the day having not yet delivered enough venom to be expelled. She leaned back on the headboard and closed her eyes tight. Her fingers scratched at the sheets. It was as if her body wanted to burrow. When it was finished, she sat for a while in a daze. "I do not know how things stand between you, and I do not wish to pry, but I am informed that Alistair is forbidden from sending or receiving letters. I do not know if you have been made aware of this, and I write to apprise you. Following the loss of his arm, Alistair was to be invalided home, but there were perhaps irregularities in the repatriation list. These came to light after Alistair reached Gibraltar, where he was taken by the Navy, having been recovered when his aircraft ditched. The upshot is that Alistair has been sentenced to 12 months' imprisonment for absence without leave. He is to serve this time in Gibraltar. I have tried to get the sentence set aside, emphasizing Alistair's selfless record and his wound. My efforts have been unsuccessful, and I pray you will both forgive me. Though Alistair was under my command, it is as his friend that I write." Mary read it through again, her hands clasped and unclasped. The world increased. It had been so long since she had numbered herself among the fortunate that she had lost all immunity to the shock of it. Joy, at first, was foreign and unsettling. After the first hour, she began to wonder what one might do. It wasn't possible to travel to Gibraltar as a civilian, nor, apparently, could she write to Alistair there. She thought it through, but nothing came. In the end, reluctantly, but it hardly dragged at her at all, she was so elated, she supposed she ought to talk to her mother. She put on her mac and limped through the sleet to untouched Pimlico. At her parents' house on Warwick Square, the white stucco facade, the classical portico, and the first-floor balcony with its sculpted box bushes all spoke of exemption from the things she had lived through. She climbed the 6 steps to the black door with its leonine knocker, but as she lifted her hand, the door swung open. One couldn't know what mechanism of housemaids and semaphore detected one's approach.
Good morning, Miss Mary.
She stepped inside as if it were nothing. Hello, Palmer. Are you well? Palmer afforded the minutest inflection of an eyebrow, sufficient to relegate his well-being to the category of things without import. Mary found that her raincoat was already across his arm.
We expect Madame home at 11. Shall you wait for her by the fire in the morning room?
Oh, yes, very good, thank you. The slightest nod. Palmer was so invariant that Mary herself was suddenly unsure whether she had been away for 7 months or 7 hours. In the morning room she sat on the green settee. On the pewter tray, Palmer brought cocoa with golden amaretti and a hint of apology.
Unless Miss might prefer sherry?
Even for a monster like me, it's a little early. His face didn't change.
I shall make a note.
Her mother came home, spilling over with cut flowers and instructions for their display. Her greying hair was dragged back in a bun. When Mary showed herself in the hallway, a single strand escaped to lift in the winter draught. Hello, said Mary.
Darling,
said her mother, the production of the word being necessary according to Newton's third law. I hope this isn't a bad time, said Mary. Her mother let her coat be taken.
You do understand that you cannot make a scene. Your father is this close to being called up to Cabinet. He may return at any time, and perhaps with a visitor. We are being careful not to display the wrong sort of periodicals, let alone... Well, there's no need to elaborate.
Oh, you've been crying. No, but... she said in a small voice, and then tears welled up and her mother's arms were around her.
I'm so tired, Mummy. Darling, of course you are. Oh, how we have missed you.
The warm air of the house blew over them, the beeswax on the banisters, and the brasso on the stair rods. Faintly, a hint of laundry on the boil. Somewhere far inside, crockery clacking as the maid did dishes, and coal rumbling as it was decanted from scuttle to podonium. Behind her mother, the front door closed with a tidy click of the latch. The wall was muted. One felt the relief of the heart as it fell in with the old, shuffling rhythms of the maids. Everything would be well again. She would have Alistair. It still seemed only half real. And so what if he had lost an arm? It was easily done in these times. The brooms swished as they swept the quiet chambers of the house. The dusters banged between balusters. In the hall, the Christmas tree, decked with Venetian glass, stood in its great brass bowl. Mary followed her mother through to the drawing-room, where Palmer brought tea and blue china. He served Mary's according to her most recent preference, without milk but with 3 sugars, the way she had taken it when the morphia had sweetened her tooth.
"Thank you, Palmer, but if it isn't too much trouble, I should like my tea the old way."
She spoke deliberately, making sure her mother understood.
"Very good,"
said Palmer, in the neutral tone he used whether one needed him to arrange a taxicab or a resurrection. He produced for her a tea without sugar and withdrew to his own measured bounds.
"Mummy," said Mary, "I'm so sorry for everything."
"Oh, shh! No one could expect perfection from you after so much loss. You'll find your room just as you left it."
"Thank you, but I'm not moving back."
"No?"
said her mother, with the mildest incredulity, as if Mary had declined a macaroon.
"But it would be so nice to have you home for Christmas."
"The thing is, I need to ask you for something."
"I see. You are yourself again, at least."
"I haven't touched morphia in months."
"I'm glad. It wasn't you at all. Shall we just forget it? You haven't done irreparable damage to your father, provided you and I now embark on a comprehensive tour of the salons. When they see you like this again, the rumours will seem far-fetched. You'll find that I have rather talked up your wound sustained in the line of duty. I hope you don't mind, since it clothed your more naked indiscretions."
"I'm sorry for the scene at the Ritz."
"So am I. The Ritz? With a brace of knickers? If you had to send me a message, it might have hurt less to tie it to a stick and beat me with it."
"Must you call them niggers? They've done nothing to you."
"Except to hook my daughter on morphia.
The reverse, Mummy. One of them got me off the stuff."
Her mother blinked.
"But then why? Of all the people a girl might consort with..."
"I am not consorting. I'm teaching."
Well, it kills me that you're doing so on my shilling. At least their parents ought to pay you a wage. Or do they even have parents? One hears that the fathers, in particular, have no more domestic feeling than do fishes.
I don't feel I give the children any more than they give me, but I will stop drawing the allowance if it pleases you.
So what do you want from me, if it is neither money, nor sane opinion, nor my simple invitation to make your poor father happy?
Mary took her mother's hand.
The man I told you I was keen on, Alistair, I love him.
Her mother stared for a moment.
I suppose you'll tell me his people are fascists or some such thing. You don't ever make it easy.
Oh, he's from a good family. Before the war, he was a conservator at the Tate.
Mary felt her mother's hand relax.
When you say a good family...
We don't know them, if that's what you mean. But you must imagine there are families unknown in our circle that nevertheless orbit the same sun and do so without eclipse or indiscretion.
I suppose they are socialists, then.
Do you? One day you must teach me how you can tell.
Her mother took her hand back.
So why do I sense a caveat?
Alistair lost an arm in Malta, and...
Oh, for heaven's sake, so what? He can always grow a new one.
Mary smiled.
I do love you, Mother. That's just what I thought.
You are a dear girl. If you weren't impossible, I shouldn't love you half so much. You're what I might have been if I'd ever had the courage to tell my mother to mind her own business.
And you're what I might hope to be, if I could put family before myself. I know I've been selfish. I shan't make any more scenes at the Ritz, but neither can I be Mrs. Henry Hunter Hall, however much it would help.
Her mother sighed.
I am sure some middle ground can be found. And I know you will give me your indulgent smile when I say this, but you will find that it is different in any case once you are married. Our own passions become muted. Well, perhaps that isn't the best word. Our passions become lighter and seem to weigh on us with less urgency. Do you imagine that I was not idealistic at your age? I was for women's votes, you know. I chained myself to things.
Why did you stop?
I suppose you will say I chained myself to your father.
You are happy, though, aren't you?
Happy? Oh, goodness, is that even a word in wartime?
But the war hardly touches you.
I expect you think nothing does.
The mother took a cigarette from Mary's pack and lit it with hands that shook a little.
Mother,
I'm not to be pitied. I still believe it our duty to leave the world improved. Do you suppose you will marry this Alistair of yours?
I don't know. He's far away, and we haven't spoken of it. But yes, I hope so.
You must choose a husband carefully, you see, because his ideals must stand in for yours. Ideals will become ambitions, and ambitions need allies, and allies require soirees and galas and seating plans.
You don't think it will be different between men and women after this war? You don't feel we are on the cusp of something?
We should make a tapestry of the cusps we've been on.
Mary smiled.
I'm glad you're right.
You're trying to distract me, I know. What did you come to ask for?
It's Alistair, Mummy. He's being detained in Gibraltar.
Well, there is a war on.
Detained by the authorities, I mean. In a... well, you know, in a building.
But why?
Mary kept her voice even.
They say he went absent without leave. He is sentenced to 12 months.
Her mother put her teacup down with a click.
Palmer, would you bring us a little brandy?
Back the pewter tray came, with glasses and decanters. Palmer set it down on the occasional table and let a measure of syrup into each of two glasses. He scalped an orange and placed a shaving of peel in each glass. These he compressed with a pestle sufficiently to release their oils, but not to macerate them. He added a dash of bitters and a measure of brandy to each glass, finishing with ice. Mary sipped her drink. Her mother drained her own glass and put it down.
"You are quite determined not to make this life agreeable for any of us."
"I'm sorry. I truly am. However it looks, I hope you know that I do not go out into the world hunting for disgrace to bring home to you."
"A deserter, though? I might have preferred a nigger after all.
Mary gathered herself.
Absence is hardly desertion. Father isn't here from one moon to the next, and yet we keep his books dusted.
Don't.
Sorry, said Mary. Her mother was silent for a moment.
So what is the situation?
I think France shook him up. It was just before we met. He has saved goodness knows how many of his men's lives, but he was awfully rattled by it all. I know he did his best in Malta, and I can't imagine losing an arm, can you? Her mother said nothing. Mary flushed. But how can they judge a man for the one time he comes up short?
What would you have me say? When Abel's blood cried out to the Lord, one supposes it was to complain of being spilled, rather than to recall the glad years of fraternity.
But Alistair hasn't murdered anyone. I think perhaps all he did was to leave a little soon.
It is a war, not a mixer. One cannot quit if it gets dreary.
I know, Mummy, but
your father did not leave a little soon at Ypres or Pozières. If he had, I should never have married him.
But surely he would understand Alistair's case better than anyone.
Your father's understanding of absence without leave might not extend beyond the range at which the absentee ought to be shot.
But we have moved on since those days. Do we still have no mechanism for forgiveness?
What would you have me say?
Won't you ask Father to use his influence? A letter to the War Office would carry tremendous weight. He need only state Alistair's character.
This is why you came to see me. To get your man off the hook.
Mary made herself small and said nothing.
Do you understand what it would cost me? From my own capital of influence with your father? I have my own causes, which you might have noticed if you were the noticing type. And those, in addition to the drain it makes on my stock each time I have to defend you. Do you even guess at how loyally I have pleaded your corner before him? And now you would drive me deeper into his debt and subordinate my own hopes to yours.
I'm sorry. I wouldn't ask if I didn't have to.
If I do this for you, the other nonsense must end. Not one drop of morphia ever again.
Of course, I promise.
And you will go to the War Office and ask for another assignment. If they send you back to the ambulances, you will go gladly. If they send you to the factories, you will don the overalls without a whimper. I will have this family's name speak of duty again.
All right.
And you will come back to live with us until you are married. You will join me with good grace at the lectures and the coffee mornings. I shall not make unreasonable demands on your time, but I will expect you to make peace with society. At least make peace to the extent that your wedding, when it does come, will feature on the society page and not on the gossip.
Mary hung her head. Fine.
And you must stop carrying on with the Negroes. I shall do you the favour of calling them Negroes, and you will reciprocate by cutting ties. You will neither frequent their entertainments nor school their numberless brood.
But, Mother,
because it is not even a kindness that you do for them, pretending they can be helped. They have their world, and we have ours, and there can be no more traffic between the two than there is between heaven and earth.
And so we prescribe the countryside for our children and the bombing for theirs? How can you ask me to make peace with a society that makes this kind of war?
Mary's mother sat down beside her.
Please. I was the same at your age.
Honest, you mean to say? I shan't rise to that.
The young see the world that they wish for. The old see the world as it is. You must tell me which you think the more honest.
Fine, said Mary.
I will do everything else you ask, since the cost is to me alone. But I won't stop teaching those children.
But why, dear?
Because everyone insists that I must stop.
And it doesn't occur to you that perhaps everyone is right? They are blind to what's wrong.
I see the wealthy untouched by this war, and the poor bombed out by it, and yet rich and poor alike make not a murmur. I see Negro children cowering in basements, while white children sojourn in the country, and yet both camps beg me not to rock the boat. Look at us, won't you? We are a nation of glorious cowards, ready to battle any evil but our own. Her mother took her hand.
Enough. If we must negotiate, then please remember I have played this game longer than you. You asked me to try for Alistair's release, and I have set out my conditions. Attach your own if you must, but please don't pretend you would choose a principal over a husband. What about Alistair's happiness, festering there in prison? Is that yours to weigh against your ideals?
You might sentence him to a year in his own company, Mother. I shan't sentence him to 50 with a hypocrite.
Please don't punish us like this. Whatever else it is that we have done to you, do be brave enough to spit it out. But please don't pretend you would choose niggers over family.
They are only children, Mummy, and they have helped me without attaching conditions. They watched each other for a moment.
Must we fight the whole thing out again?
Said her mother.
Perhaps we can leave any decision for a while, until we have both had a chance to settle down. Only do come home for Christmas, darling. Do let us be a family again.
Mary used her mother's own trick of smiling when there was nothing else to be done. Her mother stood.
Well, you must consider it. I shall go out, I think, and collect myself a little. I shall return for supper at 6, and you must let Palmer know if we should expect you. If you are here when I get home, then I shall assume my conditions are acceptable. If you are gone, then it's best we don't see each other for a while.
Mother, said Mary.
6 o'clock. Please don't be late. I don't think I could bear it.
I am so sorry, Mummy.
Mary watched her mother make herself smile. And so now they both smiled and kissed on both cheeks with precision, here and here, since after all the heart was not the foundation of manners and must not by its collapse undermine them. After her mother left, Mary sat with her elbows on the table. She lit a cigarette, blew the smoke through her nose, and the old house exhaled with her. Now that her mother was gone, the maids could sing as they made the beds upstairs. From the kitchen, pans clattered, and cook found laughter in something. After a while, Mary felt a presence in the room, an inflection of the light.
Palmer?
Miss Mary?
Might you bring me another small brandy?
On its own, no fuss.
Very good.
And would you have a cab pick me up, and let my mother know when she's back that I'm afraid I can't make it for supper?
There was an unaccustomed pause.
My apologies, Miss Mary, but I should like to make sure that I have the message correct. I'm to tell Madam that you won't be joining her.
Thank you, Palmer, for always getting the message.
A pause. A breath. And then, with no expression,
very good.
When Palmer returned with brandy, he carried it on the heavy silver tray. Mary glanced up.
Oh, is my father back from the house?
Not until this evening, madam.
Then,
his impartial eyes.
Forgive me, Miss North.
Oh, Palmer.
Will there be anything else?
No, thank you. That will be all.
Very good.
Half an hour later, when the door clicked shut behind her, Mary found Hilda in the back of the taxi that waited on the curb.
What are you doing here?
Hilda's scars were puckered and raw, her confusion twisting them still further.
I thought you had asked for me. I did nothing of the sort. Oh, but on the telephone Palmer said I was needed very urgently.
Mary softened.
And you came for my sake.
I have missed you dreadfully. Mary hesitated only for a moment.
You'd better get out then, hadn't you? We can hardly go for a stroll with you sitting in there.
Mary paid off the taxi driver, linked arms with Hilda, and they walked through the rain. They spoke of small things at first, since it was best, when reattaching threads, to begin with the easiest knots. Later, Mary said,
Alistair's alive.
Hilda put her hands to her mouth.
I love him, said Mary. Do you hate me?
No. I'm glad for you.
I've missed you too, you know.
Hilda took her hands.
Come and stay at the flat for the weekend, won't you? There's a sofa bed, the wireless, and as much tap water as you can drink. Unless you need to be at the Lyceum.
Maybe my taking a weekend off would do everyone good. You and I have met people on fire who made less fast than children being forced to learn reading.
You're a dreadful teacher anyway.
Thanks, and you're a useless nurse.
So, you'll come to stay?
Thanks. I should love to.
They walked east and north towards Hilda's flat, the undamaged streets giving way to the general destruction. The sleet came harder now. As they approached Regent's Canal, only a thin path had been cleared between the mounds of rubble.
"Don't mind the mess," said Mary. "I shall build cottages along here for you, little thatched things, such as one sees in Lowestoft, and I shall arrange for a handsome and unattached man to be installed in every one."
"Tall?"
"You'll need a ladder to kiss them. One of those two-step efforts you get in libraries."
"Dark?"
"I shall organise them by street for you. Dark, blonde, funny, rich. If you want more than one quality, you just knock near an intersection."
"Uniform?"
"Any you like. Soldier, sailor, engine driver, every house will have a dressing-up box."
"I believe I will like your new London very much."
"Then you shall be mayor of it," said Mary, sweeping an arm in a magnanimous arc.
"I suppose it should be me. You'll be too busy with Alistair." Mary saw the twitch in her friend's smile.
"I'm sorry, Hilda."
"Don't be.
You'll be married, I suppose." "He's in prison in Gibraltar."
Hilda stopped.
"What for?" "He left Malta before he should have."
Hilda looked miserable.
"I sent him a letter, you know. I told him you were gone to the dogs."
Mary considered it.
"I can't say you were wrong."
"Yes, but it wasn't right. It's no wonder I'm alone."
"Stop it. You'll meet someone soon."
"But how? There aren't any parties any more. Either that or there are parties everywhere and no one tells me."
"Yes, I should think it's that. You've always struck me as a charmless and unpopular girl."
"But it's these scars," said Hilda. "They're the only known antidote to me."
"Then we'll find you a man with scars that match."
Hilda smiled.
"See?"
said Mary.
"You're pretty when you do that."
"I don't suppose I've done it much since we fought."
"Me neither. From now on, let's remember the trick of not fighting, shall we? Why do you suppose we ever forgot?"
Hilda sniffed, turned her face up to the grey sky, and caught sleet with her tongue as it fell.
"Hard to tell," she said. "Perhaps it's something they put in the bombs."
December 1941. Mary put on her mackintosh and sou'wester hat, stubbed her cigarette, and went out into the morning. The cold weather had brought her limp back, and she nursed it through Regent's Park, skirting the deserted zoo. By the lake, its surface quick with rain, the rowing boats were drawn up under canvas. The park wardens waited under the bandstand for the weather to pass. They smoked pipes, their clothes rolled and pinned where limbs were missing. The bare oaks with their ageless trunks held up the woebegone sky. She carried on through Marylebone and Fitzrovia, which had never seen the worst of the bombing. Only a few gaps spoiled the Georgian terraces, and the rubble had been carted away. Where there were craters, the rain had flooded them, so that the spaces between the houses mirrored the sky and made from each loss, if not beauty, then at least a quiet neighbour. Mary walked down to the embankment and looked out over the broad sweep of the river from Parliament to Blackfriars. She no longer lingered here, but it was not possible to lose the lover's habit of looking downstream to the sea. She tightened her mackintosh at the throat and hurried on to the Lyceum. This was the best part of the day, looking forward to teaching her class. There were 9 coloured children living in the basement now. It had taken the war to reveal London's heart, centrifugal for white children and gravitational for Negroes. When it was all over, she supposed, Miss Vine would bring her school back, and all her teachers would carry on quite deliberately as if nothing had happened. They would even make a virtue of it in makeshift classrooms, thinking themselves the Stoics. They would have no idea at all that life had soldiered on without them. In the auditorium, the minstrels were taking a break from rehearsal. They sprawled around the stage on boxes and folded drapes, smoking.
"Good morning, Miss North,"
Bones called out. Mary stopped at the foot of the stage.
"Good morning, Mr. Bones. How goes the minstrelsy trade?"
"In its usual way, thank you for asking, which is to say, proportionate with your people's kind purchase of tickets. How goes teaching?"
"In its customary manner, thank you, with 2 steps forward and 1.5 back, or half a step forward when expressed in net terms."
He came to the front of the stage.
"A minute of your time, Miss North, which I believe is 1/60th of an hour when expressed as a fraction."
They climbed up to a high row in the auditorium and sat on the fold-down seats, leaving an empty one between them.
"This thing you're doing for our children," he said. "So kind. Though there's been some talk that it might be better if you didn't come every day." She smiled. Children will say that, won't they? But the truth is, letters and arithmetic come best through daily practice. I try to make it fun, but there's no substitute for the weekday grind. Bones looked at his hands. "The talk that he might come less often, it isn't from the children."
"Oh, I see."
"It isn't that we're not grateful. What you've done for them is terrific. I see kids who couldn't read who are writing now. I see kids who wouldn't talk, and suddenly they won't quit nagging me for money."
"Well, then, it's just that these things don't always end well. See what I'm saying?" "I'm not sure I do. Surely it doesn't harm them to learn. Quite the reverse. When their peers come back from the countryside, they'll need to hold their own."
"We're not saying they shouldn't be learning. We're maybe asking, respectfully, if you're the best one to teach them." Down on the stage, the minstrels were rehearsing a slapstick piece with a long plank and all its attendant physics. Mary had never realized how many men must be hit in the face before such a thing became funny. "The fact is," said Bones, "we've got our thing going on here, and people leave us alone. We have our trade, and this theater to work in, and a home of sorts for the children who've lost their people. While it's just us, no one pays us mind. But if people thought we were mixing, they'd pay us more attention, which for us is like daylight for vampires. You see what I'm saying? There's an understanding between life and the colored entertainer. Your people give us a corner of the night, and we don't darken your day."
"But I hardly come and go with a fanfare. I use the stage door, and I teach in the basement."
"You may come discreetly into our place, Miss North, but I wonder how carefully you leave yours."
"I don't brag about what I'm doing, if that's what you mean."
"Do your friends know? Do your mother and father?"
"Yes, but..."
"And do they wholeheartedly approve?"
"No, but that hardly..."
"And so they talk to people, and people talk. Are we licensed for the number of shows we do? Are we allowed to sell drink? Did any of those orphan children come with adoption papers and ration cards? And yet we are afforded the comfort of our small community because it would take wearisome paperwork to scatter us. We're forgiven our skins, you see, so long as no one officially notices."
Mary hung her head.
"You want me to stop coming?"
"It's not anything I want, Miss North. We're all partial to you. But you mustn't think the children won't get their schooling. I may not have your facility, but I can give them the language. And the manager, he isn't going to be teaching them any mathematical theorems, but he has been known to balance the books."
"What if I started coming less often?"
He pursed his lips and looked down on the stage.
"Fine. What if you started today?"
And so here she was, leaving before she'd even had time to take off her raincoat. She wondered if perhaps the months of morphia had weakened her tendency to resist. Or else it was the solitude, in which the self hardened, but also grew brittle. It was always a lurch, coming out of the Lyceum into the crowd of white faces in the Strand. There was a period of acclimatization, until one stopped finding white skin strange. Until then it seemed unnatural and rather horrid, as if something medical or blanchingly industrial had happened to everyone. There was a moment before one understood that one belonged with them, a moment outside time, as if one had stood up too suddenly.
January 1942. The four local men who brought Captain Braxton's body back up the cliff to Fort St. Elmo had done the best they could to make it decent, straightening the limbs and wrapping a shirt around the ruined head. Simonson thanked them with a promissory note for kerosene, then had the surgeon decant the dead man into a coffin and nail it shut. The nails had to be extracted from the doorposts of the fort and straightened on an anvil. Simonson stubbed out something they were still calling a cigarette. He pawed at his tongue for the bitter tobacco fragments that had stuck there. His head pounded. The battery under his command stood at 77 men, with Braxton freshly subtracted. There were rations enough for 30. It was a feature of the tactical situation that the more men he lost, the more the rest could eat. When a raid came, one didn't know whether to send the men down to the shelters in their tin hats or up to the ramparts in their PT shorts. Occasionally, an officer dealt with this and all other uncertainties forever by taking a stroll at dawn and not stopping when he came to the sea cliffs. Simonson supposed one should feel pity at a suicide, but he rather hated the dead man for it. Absent Alistair's good humour, the island had become lethal to his spirit. It was as if an invisible bile seeped from the bomb craters. He loathed every yellow rock. Since there was nothing to eat, he smoked in an uninterrupted chain until smoke seeped into the gaps between every cell of his body. Until it was only force of habit that caused the smoke, and not his person, to disperse. All morning his subordinates plagued him. Captains Appleby and Fisk had fallen out over which of their guns ought to receive a new barrel that had been fought through. Simonson flipped a threepenny bit along the corridor and had them chase after it to decide. Lieutenant Spencer reported, assuming he would be captain now that Braxton had left the situation vacant. 5 minutes later, Lieutenant Cooper dropped by to confirm, just as a nudge between old Harrovians, that he, and not the overweening Spencer, was in line for the same promotion. All afternoon it went on, while the enemy attacked. Down poured the rain of blood and sulphur, and up slunk these privateers from their underground parts of the fort. Here was Major Huntley Chamberlain, hoping that it would be his favourite Ives who took the vacant captaincy. Here was Major Hall, lobbying for Williams. At dusk, at last, Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton summoned him to his office. For the first time in weeks, Simonson felt something akin to gratitude. Having noticed how overstretched he was, Hamilton must finally be disposed to take some of the heat off. Simonson put on his cleanest shirt, blew the dust off his cap, and hurried down to the ops room. Hamilton glanced up from his papers when Simonson knocked.
"Too bad about Braxton."
"Dreadful, sir."
"Married?"
"No, just parents."
"Well, that's something. Killed in action, I suppose."
"I'll get the letter off tonight."
"Fine. Do sit."
Simonson did. He crossed his legs and put his cap on his knee. He supposed he was to be loaned to HQ for a spell. It didn't do to think of it as a holiday. One ought to relish the added responsibility, but just now he felt only relief at the prospect of release from daily command. Hamilton returned to his papers. He paged through the quartermaster's weekly provisions report, and it seemed he intended to read the thing in its entirety. Simonson felt a snap of unease. The longer one was made to wait, the harder it was to like what one waited for. He kept his eyes on the wall map of the island, as if the siege might be lifted by further study. Hamilton finished the report, took a red pencil, and made careful annotations in the margins of several pages. This gross of biscuits to be issued, that ounce of aspirin to be allocated to sick bay. Finally, he took off his reading glasses, lit a cigarette, and slid a typed sheet across the desk.
"Have you any explanation for this?"
He rocked back in his chair, and watched Simonson read the document. It was a signed statement from a junior officer at Lucca, admitting to having moved Heath up the evacuation order under instructions from Royal Artillery. Simonson looked up.
"The poor man has completely misunderstood, of course. I brought no special pressure to bear, and I certainly issued no order."
"He must be exaggeratedly stupid, then."
Simonson gave a thin smile.
"Amused, Simonson?"
"I hoped you'd called me in for good news."
Hamilton stood and went to the narrow, barred window. With his back to Simonson, he looked out over the darkening courtyard where 400 men, following orders, were lying on the ground to save strength.
"I know you were friendly with Heath. You sunbathed. You sailed."
"I tried to be agreeable with all my fellow officers."
"Don't soft soap it. You two were thick as thieves."
"Not really, sir. Heath meant no more to me than the others."
Saying it made him feel as close to ashamed as starvation permitted. How good it had been, back then, to chat with Alistair of this and that while the sun tanned them and the local beer softened their responsibilities. They had lain sprawled together like puppies, laughing till their sides ached. They had shared a grace that even the enemy sensed. Fighter pilots had stayed their hands on the firing switch. Mines had missed them by inches, by the gap between auguring stars.
"The word is important," said Hamilton. "Are you quite sure the two of you weren't friends?"
"If you must know, I thought Heath rather inferior.
If I made an effort with him from time to time, it was because I felt sorry for him.
To be clear, you thought him socially inferior?
It's hardly a man's fault, but yes. I'm afraid it comes down to that. Anyway, he wouldn't be the first who'd queered things to get off the island.
No, but he'd be the first from an honourable regiment. I hope you still appreciate the distinction.
I do, sir.
So you say Heath pulled strings, and you had nothing to do with it?
God damn it, yes.
And if I were to ask Heath the same question, no doubt he would say that it was you who pulled the strings, and that he had no hand in the affair.
If he has any sense at all, I hope that's exactly what he'll say.
They watched each other while the old war turned through another minute of arc.
I see, said Hamilton at last.
I'm very sorry.
Do you know what my day consists of now? HQ gives me orders that are almost supernatural. This calorific requirement to be transcended, these mortal wounds to be healed, those laws of nature to be revoked. As if we weren't soldiers, but saints.
I remember when we were human beings.
Yes. Well, I don't suppose you'd have let Heath take the swing on his own back then.
Simonson closed his eyes. A girlfriend had written the week before. Catherine, trusting he was having fun. He remembered her at Oxford, her hair smelling of strawberries, their punt adrift among the meadows of the Charwell, his cheerful incompetence with the pole, the summer sun fixing the memory, immortalizing her laughter even as it pealed. Outside, another raid was starting up. The courtyard emptied as everyone hurried to the guns. Simonson stood.
I should go to my men.
Stay where you are. What good to them is a man like you?
Simonson sat back down. The bombs came, shaking the earth, deepening his headache until he felt his skull must crack. Officers, bloody and disheveled, began to bring their reports. Communications with HQ were cut. Number 9 gun was a total loss. Granfield and Barlow were killed. Hamilton sat behind his desk and took the reports one by one.
Do you see it yet? He said in a lull. Do you see it from my point of view? Because I have all night, you know. We can do this as long as you like.
More reports came.
Oh, look,
said Hamilton, sliding a damaged chit across the desk.
That aimer on 9 gun, you know, the Geordie, he's had the front of his foot blown off. Shall we give him an evacuation number, do you think? Or shall we pull some strings?
Simonson held his aching head while bombs blew it apart.
Interesting, said Hamilton, replacing the handset of the field telephone. There's a second casualty from that hit on 9 gun.
He... All right, said Simonson. You've made your point.
The war would grind them down until all that remained was this bitter and sullen fury pounding in the centre of his skull. The war would find the true hearts of them all as it found his own heart now, incensed, incandescent, unconsoled. The raid died away. The guns fell silent. In the hiatus before the all-clear, there was the stuttering sound of the damaged tail-enders fleeing.
"I hope you also see it from my point of view," said Simonson. "For someone he cares about, a man must do what he can."
"Regardless of the social order?"
"Regardless of the evacuation order."
"I see. So you cut a few corners for Heath." "I won't say it's unnatural, only unbecoming. Of an officer, you understand?"
"I admit nothing," said Simonson.
"Then we must do it by the book. One of you pulled strings, and if it wasn't you, then logically it must have been him. So I will wire the CO at Gibraltar and have him put that to Heath. And as you say, if Heath has an ounce of sense, he will deny any knowledge, and you'll both be off the hook. I expect that's what he'll say, don't you?"
Simonson turned his cap over and over.
Hamilton said, "It's just that you would need to be certain, wouldn't you, that Heath shared your cynical disposition. Otherwise, there's no guarantee he won't simply do the honourable thing and own up, and serve out the whole of his 12 months in the loneliest jail in the Empire. Might not even survive it in his condition."
"Please, I do understand."
"Then I shall give you till dawn to think it over." "Let me have your answer then. Dismiss."
Simonson turned in the doorway.
"Sir, why must you do this?"
"I wouldn't if we had any bread." All I've left to give the men is fairness.
Back in his room, Simonson sat on his cot. A damaged moon was easing itself up from the sea, and he wished it wouldn't. One would be released from all cares, at last, if the moon and sun didn't always pop up like hospital visitors. He wished the Germans would make an effort and sink them both for good. The orderly had brought a new stack of paperwork and squared it away on his desk. Alistair had gifted Simonson his jar of blackberry jam, and he laid it on the stack now as a paperweight. He rubbed the fatigue from his eyes and sat to write the next day's manning order. Number one gun would have a full crew. Number two would be half-manned. Number three would be... Oh, but it hardly mattered. The magazines were empty. His eyes strayed to the jam, where the moonlight crept through the jar. The deep ruby colour connected directly with his hunger. He could hardly force himself to stop looking. Saliva flooded his mouth. He spat and lit another bitter cigarette. If Alistair was too stupid to deny everything, then surely that was Alistair's lookout. After the surprise and humiliation of his interview with Hamilton, Simonson shook. How could Alistair put him in this position? This was the disappointment with grammar school boys. They pounded on the door and then had no idea how to behave once admitted. He found his eyes on the jar again. However irritating Alistair was, to eat the jam would be a betrayal. He was supposed to keep it, to share it with Alistair at War's End. But it wouldn't do any harm to take off the lid, surely, and smell it. It would not reduce by any fraction the quantity of jam that remained. And how many months had it been since he had smelled anything but smoke? Gun smoke, smoke of cigarettes and pipes, smoke from conflagrations terrestrial and naval, smoke screens laid down for cover. He was curious to know if he could still smell anything else. He unscrewed the jar and breathed in. He tried again. Nothing. The two possibilities arising, that the jam was odourless, or that he had lost the facility for scents less brutal than smoke, seemed equally bleak. He replaced the lid and picked up his pen again, but he was too hungry for paperwork. Perhaps Alistair would deny all knowledge, and they'd both be in the clear. Simonson considered it with a quick kick of hope, then came up short. Of course Alistair would do nothing of the sort. He eyed the jam again. If he had lost his sense of smell, what else had he lost? It was known that battle stress numbed the senses one by one. What he feared most was that his will was gone. It was said that the self surrendered by small degrees before it finally collapsed. Panic tightened in his chest. What if he could not taste? He unscrewed the lid again, scooped jam onto the blunt end of his pen, and tried it. All over the desiccated island, the bomb craters filled with rainwater. They overflowed, voiding their poison, until the water that pooled in them was sweet. Soon the first green algae began to bloom in their waters. Little creatures, outlandish and fitfully ambulant, multiplied on the bounty. Their tiny bodies quivered with unheard laughter. They lived and died, and their resonant forms drifted down to the depths, and as the sediment grew richer, plants took root in it and reached up for the light, and were salves and banes and lilies. Their leaves unfurled, and their stamens shook with laughter. Finches came and rested on the stems. The leaves trembled, the birds swayed like gymnasts, the laughter shook the air. More rains came, and seasons, and early evenings with light so delicate and shimmering that the laughter made ripples in the light, and turned the light to its own form, and the light made itself into the undulant bodies of lovers. Catherine looked up at him, while the river looped around meadows. Simonson cradled his head. It was the most beautiful thing he had ever tasted. How tired he had been, how lost. He screwed the lid back on the jam and replaced it on top of the stack of paperwork. One found new uses for the equipment one had. He would tell Hamilton the truth and finish the war as a sergeant, yelling at buttons and shoes. At dawn he shaved, combed his hair, and went down to the ops room. "Sir," he said to Hamilton, "Heath knew nothing. He'd recently lost his arm. He'd lost Briggs, who was his friend, and he was in no state to make judgments.
I ordered Heath to take the painting back to the church, and the loss of Briggs and the truck was my responsibility. I ordered Heath onto the evacuation flight. He had no agency in any of it, and nor did Med Command. I told them it was orders from top brass.
Hamilton came out from behind his desk to shake Simonson's hand.
You understand, Douglas, that I really shall have to write this report, that the entire thing falls on you.
I understand, Fraser, and I'm sorry to ask you to do it.
You shall have a rest now, at least.
Simonson tried for a smile.
Well, that's something.
Hamilton sighed, sat back down, and nodded at the wall map of Malta.
Now we can speak freely. What would you do if you were in charge of the show? With the strength we have, and the provisions remaining, and the enemy able to parachute into any location.
Simonson studied the map.
I think I might ask the men, sir.
Hamilton blinked.
I certainly never had you as a Democrat.
I mean I might ask for volunteers. There are some who will surrender in any case when the chance comes, and it seems useless to require them to fight if they can bear a life in captivity. And there are others who will prefer to resist, even though the outcome is clear. I think we have all been here long enough to know our minds by now.
So you would split our force?
Into two camps, yes. One to yield, another to hold.
And in which of the two camps are you?
Simonson smiled.
Who knows which takes more courage? To die in battle or to live in vain? It cuts all of us in two, I suppose.
Hamilton frowned at the map.
And yet, you see, we are only issued with one island.
March 1942. In the first big southwesterly of the year, the Americans arrived in London. They came with the storm at their backs, up from Southampton, in trucks. They ran a muscular breed of convoy, widening the roads where they had to, shrugging off the bombed-out houses with big-chested bulldozers they had shipped with them from Maine. When they reached the capital, though the officers were too good to mention it, they were amazed at how tiny it was. The landmarks were bigger in their photographs. The British themselves were quite small.
"Say that again in your accent,"
said a lieutenant who had asked Mary for directions. She did, and it made both of them laugh. To discover that one had an accent was quite unexpected and wonderful. Mary had seen the column rolling along the Strand on her way to the Lyceum. The children had already been out watching it, and it was hopeless to imagine that she could teach them on a day like this. She had joined them instead, as they stood in a neat line on the pavement, oldest to youngest, waving American flags they had made.
"What's with all the Negroes, ma'am?" said the lieutenant.
"Oh," said Mary, "you'll find that almost everyone in Britain is coloured. Didn't they tell you in your briefing?"
The lieutenant looked at her in perfect bafflement.
"No, ma'am."
"Well, I'm surprised. As far as the Scotch border, we are as dark as pitch. It's only north of there that the race is diluted."
"And you, ma'am?"
"I'm an albino." "Oh, don't look so worried. It's fine, really it is, once one gets used to the persecution."
She had the class salute him as he climbed back into the cab of his truck, laughing and shaking his head. Mary turned to Zachary.
"Did you think they'd be like this?"
"I thought they'd be like my father."
His tender expression, his nonchalance, briefly overwhelmed. Mary tried not to smile. Men were empty hats, after all, from which rabbits popped only by a learned effort of conjuring.
"Did you think they'd come in white gloves, playing the baby grand?"
"I thought there'd be some black people."
"Hitler will only fight them in separate units. He's a snob."
"Look at all this. Look how many soldiers there are."
"And all come to save us. I can tell you now how worried I was."
"We'll win now, won't we?"
said Zachary.
"All I know is that it's good not to stand alone any more. I don't suppose we could have held out much longer on our own."
"And what about you?"
"Oh, I'm hardly alone. I have my friends and my family."
She looked at him.
"And I have..."
He touched her arm.
"If ever you need me, I can come and help. Wherever I am, if you start at the theatre, they can find me."
She smiled, thinking how sweet it was at his age.
"Thank you," she said. "But I'll manage. I'm ever so..."
She tailed off, noticing how steadily he held her eye. The convoy rolled on. When the next gap in it came, the children would cross back to the theatre side of the street, and she would stay on her own. She realized this was understood now.